Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Cicada Tree by Robert Gwaltney, narrated by Allison Johnson. Come away, O human child, to the waters and the wild with a fairy hand in hand, for the world's more full of weeping than you can understand. W.B. Yeats, The Stolen Child. Chapter 1, Providence, Georgia, 1956. A storm was coming. Way off in the distance, its inky edges began to spoil the late morning sky. A low roll of thunder grumbled from the ground, tickling the bottom of my bare feet.
"How many more?"
Etta Mae said, holding the front of her dress out before her like a basket. "A bushel or two." I plucked another cicada shell from the bark of a pine that grew in the far corner of Mama's old thinking spot. Etta Mae giggled.
"I love you a bushel and a peck," she sang, her voice holding a sort of magic that shot clean through like winter static, through anyone who listened.
I smiled, the corners of my mouth pulling back from the lovely sound.
"A bushel and a peck?"
I laid the shell gently to rest with the others. Etta Mae blinked down into the mound of casings.
"Where did they come from?"
I spooled a length of my hair around my finger.
"From the ground," I said, pulling my finger free, leaving a perfect curl down the front of my blouse. "That's what your granny says."
I stood tall, placing my hands on my hips, speaking deep in my best Miss Wessie voice. "They needs room to grow." Etta Mae squinted her eyes and giggled. 13 years had passed. 13 long years since the cicadas last came, years before Etta Mae and I were born. Now they returned, digging loose from the earth, attaching themselves to trees, leaving behind a fragile crop of amber-tinted shells. It was the cicada singing I remember best, their courting song. It was this frenetic beckoning for the affection of another that stirred the humid air to reckless speeds that summer, the summer I turned 11. The earth grumbled again.
"Sure must be a dark, lonely place down there," Etta Mae said.
"I reckon so." I eyed a shell big as a ping-pong ball. Etta Mae hummed, slow and sad, the quality of it a drape blocking away the happy. I knew then, before she would speak, of whom she was thinking.
"Poor sweet mama,"
she said, looking down at the ground.
"Dark and lonely."
"Annalise Newell? Etta Mae Johnston?"
Miss Wessie yelled from the back porch.
"Get your little fannies back on in this house."
"Shh." I touched my finger to Etta Mae's lips. That had been a game of ours, evading Miss Wessie, our warden that summer and 3 before. Our mamas knew one another from packing pickles into jars at the Mayfield Pickle Company, my mama at the white table and Etta Mae's at the colored.
"You got till I drop these biscuits to dumplings,"
Miss Wessie said.
"Then I'm breaking off a switch."
"Then I'm breaking off a switch," I mimicked, puffing up my chest, grabbing hold of my hips, hoping to bring Etta Mae back from thoughts of her poor dead mama, to dissolve the sadness she sang into the air. A gust of wind swept across the old garden, dozens of husks blowing free from Etta Mae's apron.
"Best hurry.
Get on over to the bench." I motioned to the rickety seat. Etta Mae settled herself on the splitting wood, mindful of the delicate cargo gathered up in the front of her dress.
"I wish you didn't have to go."
"Me neither," she said, smiling, but I knew it was only half true. I was certain it was singing she loved best, even more than me, even if it was singing at a stranger's funeral.
"I'm ready."
I nodded, glancing off into the horizon, a swirl of smoky clouds moving across a perfect plain of blue. I still held the enormous shell I pulled last from the tree.
"This one first."
I positioned the prickly appendages into a coarse plait atop the center of her head. I made busy placing several more.
How's it looking?
I stepped back to regard my work.
Just one more.
Girls, Mama hollered from the house, the last dumpling's been dropped. Etta Mae took in a quick breath of air. I tucked the cicada shell into the pocket of my dress.
You look beautiful.
I admired the crown I made.
Miss Cicada Bug, 1956.
I kissed her cheek.
We best get.
Etta Mae touched her hand to her face.
Granny's done dropped the last.
She hopped from the bench, letting loose the hem of her dress, our work released to the rising wind.
Come on,
she said, grabbing hold of my hand. A whirl of storm blew my hair about my face. Etta Mae pulled at me, but I held firm, my toes pinching the ground. An errant shell clung to strands of my hair. I watched as it bucked in the gale until it let loose at last, lifted by the current, sucked away into the newly darkened sky. A shiver shot up my back. Only then did I loosen my toes from the earth, letting Etta Mae untether me from the spot. Only once did I turn back, just long enough to watch the first lightning strike. That moment the sky caught fire. The sky boomed, rattling the walls of our clapboard house, jostling the windows in their shoddy frames. Etta Mae and I passed the hour at Daddy's old upright, attempting to rehearse the stranger's funeral song. Etta Mae's gift was singing, and mine the piano, each of us the perfect accompaniment to the other. Though I never played it before, Stormy Weather was the only song my heart could remember, as though it were the only song that ever was. I always knew how to play, where my fingers should go, an instinct planted way down deep, just as easy as breathing. Daddy thought it had been he who taught me, but I knew long before, back before I first opened my eyes to the world. It was easy pretending, just a little lie, a reason to be close, if just for a spell. But that was when he loved us, Mama and me, before he drank all the good away.
Sure is pretty, Miss Wessie hollered from the kitchen. The two of you could coax an angel right down from heaven.
Don't it make you sad? I said. Singing for dead folks?
She sucked in her bottom lip, then let it loose.
No, not really.
She cast her green-flecked eyes down at her hands, running them the length of her fingers. But I knew the truth of it. Somewhere in that deep-down spot where the music lived and swirled, I knew when she sang for her poor, sweet mama. Percussion rolled above us, vibrating the floorboards. Piano keys shivered. Everywhere was music, even in the clink of Mama's jelly jar vase.
Wish I could go with you.
My voice sounded peculiar amidst the storm's refrain.
Me too.
Etta Mae sat down next to me on the piano bench, leaning her head against my shoulder.
But you get to go to the Mayfields.
She feathered her fingers across my arm.
Folks say the whole town could fit right inside their house.
I guess. I contemplated the size of such a place, the place Mama went on Saturdays to earn extra money. Must take a long time to clean.
Maybe you could play with Marlissa.
Marlissa, such a pretty name. I poked gently at the cicada shell hidden inside my pocket. In truth, I knew very little of the Mayfields or their daughter Marlissa. Mama never spoke of them, and I had yet to see one up close and in the flesh. Only the passing of their long black car through town, the world caught and reflected in the sheen of its darkened windows.
One more time, Miss Wessie said from the kitchen. Then it's dressing time.
The rain dissipated, the weight of Miss Wessie's feet across the floorboards audible once more. Etta Mae lifted her head from my shoulder. The cicada shell shifted in my pocket, the sharp tips of its legs sticking into my skin, grabbing hold around my finger. I flicked at the thing until it turned loose, my fingers finding their place on the keys. Etta Mae did not wait for my music, finding the song within her without the help of a single note of mine. I pulled my hands from the piano and listened, sorrow seeping from the perfect pitch of her soprano. I sat, eyes shut, letting her enchantment settle over me, feeling a tingle just under my skin, the weight of the thing growing until it sat heavy, pressing against my insides, until there was nothing left for me to do but cry. Rain fell against the tin, at first a smattering, the tempo gaining speed, the force greater, until there was no other sound. Nothing left of the music but a deafening whir and the vinegary taste of sadness on my tongue. Chapter 2. I leaned forward, looking up through the truck's windshield at a two-story brick building, my eyes following the loops and flourishes of the iron scrollwork. "Mistletoe," I said, reading the letters at the top of the enormous iron gate. Before Mama could knock or toot the horn, I spoke again.
"Looks like nobody's home."
"That's not the house."
"Plenty big enough to be a house. What is it, then?"
The building, a place large as any home I ever saw, was bigger than the one my best friend Jane Fenton lived in on Broad Street with her hateful twin sister Virginia. I tugged at the end of my ponytail. Mama and I sat, regarding the place. The old Ford pickup rattled and hummed, the ruckus sending vibrations through the seat. My stomach, already sour from the taste of Etta Mae's sorrow, did not take kindly to the whole affair. Never had I tasted music, and the occurrence left me unsettled and wanting to go home. "It's the gatehouse," Mama said, staring straight ahead, her words holding a rhythm in harmony with the truck's thrum. Her hand pressed into the horn, three quick honks. She cranked down the window, the glass wobbling and vanishing into the door.
"Halbert!" Mama yelled. "Halbert!"
"Who are you hollering at?"
"The gatekeeper." Mama pushed at the truck door. "You stay put." Mama walked toward the gate's archway, a space cutting clear through the middle of the building. Hands firm upon her tiny hips, she yelled his name again. I watched her gray eyes drift up above the building, gazing into the mottled sky, scratching at the old snakebite scar on her arm. I pushed at my door. The old rattletrap refused to budge. I slid myself across the seat to the steering wheel and hopped down onto the ground.
"Mama, get on back up in the truck before you muss yourself."
She walked toward the gate, smoothing her floral cotton dress, and pushed at the right side of the gate. It relented, the sound of iron and hinges playing an unsettling chord, pimpling my ankles clean all the way up my back. I tugged at the hem of my yellow gingham dress, trying to pull it to my knees. My legs, refusing to cooperate, had grown longer since Mama had sewed it for me at the start of spring. A man spoke from behind, startling me.
"Miss Grace?"
I spun about, my shabby brogans wedging into the rain-softened earth, tipping me off balance.
"Halbert! Sweet Lord Jesus, where have you been?"
My eyes ran the length of the man, stopping at the scar blossoming from the collar of his shirt, growing wider up his neck and gobbling up his ear. He stared back at me when he answered, one eye blinking quicker than the other, a pair of broken baby doll eyes.
"Been around,"
he said, turning away his bad side from view.
"Who's this here?"
I wanted to take a step backwards, to lay space between us. Mama moved toward me, the sound of gravel crunching beneath her saddle-brown ballet pumps.
"This here is my daughter, Annalise."
She rested her hands on my shoulders.
"Miss Annalise,"
he said, contemplating the name.
"You look a bit like your mama."
One of his eyes clicked shut, and then the other.
"But it's the eyes that's different."
He took a step forward, showing the whole of his misshapen face.
I might have seen them eyes before. Whose eyes is it you got?
I reckon they're my eyes. Mama squeezed my shoulders.
How's old Claxton Newell these days?
Halbert glanced at Mama that time.
Still raising hell down on that river?
The old man chuckled, his face more gruesome with a smile, his scar pulling his right eye down to his cheek. Claxton is as drunk and sorry as ever, Mama said. Of course you know that. Everybody does. The sound of her words shocked me, hard and deliberate, ugly. Mama never spoke ill of Daddy in my presence. That was Miss Wessie's way, not Mama's. Mama was all whispers and door latches. I tried to turn to Mama to look up into her face, but she held my back firm against her. Halbert nodded at Mama, his awful smile put away. Awkwardness strung together the length of silence until the old man spoke.
They done come back.
He cupped his hand to his disfigured ear.
Can't you hear them?
Who's come back? Mama said, her voice weary, the edges dipped in annoyance.
Them old locusts,
he said. He took another step closer.
They got secrets they keep. Things they know and keep buried down in the ground with them until they have the mind to come back, to sing out what they know.
What kind of secrets? I said.
Just listen,
he said, lifting his chin. The drone of cicadas rose up around us, stirring fear around my insides like a spoon in a tea glass. Enough of that nonsense, Mama said. You open up that gate. Halbert nodded, his eyes out of sync with the movement of his head. Mama nudged me forward. Get back on up in the truck and roll up that window.
Mind your secrets, Halbert said. Keep 'em close.
Mama eased the truck forward. I took my time rolling up the window, wanting to hear more. He walked alongside the truck laughing, his fingers poking in and wiggling at the top of my window, pulling them free just as the glass rolled shut. Above the engine's commotion and the drone of cicadas, he spoke louder.
Just listen,
he said, drumming his hands against the side of the truck.
Listen.
Pay him no mind, Mama said. He's not right in the head. The road beyond the gatehouse wound into what I thought must be a forest. One tree twisting into another, fighting for skinny slices of light creeping through the foliage. What is this place? The song on the radio turned to static. Mama leaned closer to the wheel, squinting into the artificial dusk. Mayfield Wood. She twisted at the radio knob until the fizzle was gone. Stifled by the heat, I cranked down the window, letting in a whoosh of cooler air and cicada screech. I yelled above the racket.
Why can't I go with Etta Mae?
Any place seemed better than there in the choke of greedy trees and heat and that creepy old gatekeep. We've been over and over that, and you know I don't mind one bit, but other folks do. Now, what is it I done told you time and time before? I curled the ends of my yellow hair ribbon around my finger.
A colored church is no place for a white girl child.
I leaned back into the ripped upholstery, the jagged edges poking at my spine.
Why do you have to work on Saturday anyway?
Because your daddy drinks all our money away. Mama rarely spoke ill of Daddy, and in a matter of minutes she disparaged him twice. But she was right. I knew the truth of the thing, had stuck my fingers into my ears to keep from hearing, humming to myself until I fell off to sleep at night.
I hate him,
I said. Not so much because I really did, but because I needed to hate something right then and there.
Mind yourself.
Mama accelerated the truck.
You can help me with the chores. How about that?
The sudden draw of air tugged at my hair ribbon,
fluttering loose bits of hair to tickle my face.
I don't want to help.
I recalled Etta May's suggestion.
Maybe I can play with Marlissa.
I sat upright, leaning away from the window, and looked at Mama. Her hair, the same color as my own, was pulled from her face into a twist, her forehead crinkled up and busy thinking. The Mayfields won't be there. They spend Saturdays over in Tallahassee at the country club. Nothing about the day was going my way. Besides, Mama bit at her lip. Mrs. Mayfield wouldn't take to you playing with Miss Marlissa. Her matter-of-fact tone did not diminish the blow.
Why? What's wrong with me?
Baby, nothing's wrong with you. Mama softened her words. Little girls who live in little houses can't play with little girls who live in big ones, that's all. I knew that could not be entirely true. After all, I played with Jane Fenton, and she and her family lived in a home much bigger and finer than ours. And I played with Etta May, and their little house only had one room with no indoor plumbing.
Then how come I can play with Etta May?
That's different.
How so?
The cab of the truck brightened, the tangle of quarreling trees finding forgiveness and turning loose, letting in the sky. I stared through the cracked windshield, a vista of oaks sprawling before us. It was then I saw it, a Goliath of column and brick. I leaned forward, placing my hands on the dash. The gravel of the driveway churned and slid beneath the jalopy's slick tires. Never had I seen anything like it.
That's a house?
That's Mistletoe. Mama and I stood at the rear portico. She tugged at the hem of my skirt. When did you get taller?
Miss Wessie said I'm shooting up quicker than a cornstalk.
Nothing left to let out. Guess it's Etta May's now.
Good. Will you make me a blue one?
I spoke half-heartedly, distracted by the enormity of the wooden door before us and what might lay beyond. Fabric's not free. Mama pinched at my chin, tilting my face up to meet her own. It was the tired in her eyes that struck me. Bluish-black rings below her lashes, accentuating her dark gray irises, setting her eyes off in a beautifully peculiar way.
Daddy drinks all the money away, I whispered.
Mama squeezed her eyes shut.
Annalise.
Her eyes opened and drifted to my collar. She leaned in closer, inspecting the tiny daisies embroidered at the edges with her fingers. Though Mama was brilliant with a needle and thread, it was her ability to read the future in her own sewing that was the true gift, an ability as much a part of her as the music inside me. This knack, never discussed in the Christian company of others, was hardly a secret. Such goings-on could hardly be contained within the weak seams of a place like Providence.
What do you see, Mama?
The cicadas drifted to quiet, then riled up again. She shook her head and turned me loose.
Just a pretty girl.
She pulled my ponytail over my shoulder, fanning the end of it across my collar, covering up the daisies.
We best get on about the day.
She took a few steps toward the door, then turned back to me. Stay close to Mama. Don't want you getting lost.
Yes, ma'am.
I tossed back my hair, running a finger across Mama's embroidery. Mama pounded her fist against the enormous door, the sound a faint hollow thud. She stepped back, and I leaned my head in to listen for any signs of a stir. Nothing could be heard except for the rising cicada buzz, a sound so fierce the vibrations caused my skin to tingle.
Maybe nobody's home.
I hoped that time it was not true. More than anything, more than I wanted to be with Etta May, I wanted to be there at Mistletoe, to see inside. Mama knocked again, then pushed at the door until there was ample space for her to fit her face through the crack.
Mercy?
Mama sometimes spoke of Mercy, the Mayfield maid. The familiar name was a comfort there in the strangeness.
Mama pushed at the door again, and I followed close behind, peering around her slow-moving hips. We entered through the kitchen, an expansive, good-smelling place with gleaming edges. It was not the impressive size of the place, or the glossy black-and-white checkerboard floor that held fascination. Across the room, a fireplace roared.
"It's summertime,"
I whispered, perplexed by the queer nature of the thing. "Mrs. Mayfield has peculiar ways. Now you stay here." She pointed to a table and 10 chairs. "I'm going to see about Mercy." I tugged at the hem of my skirt, watching Mama pass through the archway, wondering how long a girl's legs could grow in a day. The heat from the fireplace grew more oppressive, a slick of perspiration forming at the nape of my neck beneath the weight of my ponytail. Alone there with the fire, a terrible anxiousness rattled from my temples all the way down through my right foot. I watched and listened to my worn loafer tap a paradiddle on the floor. I slowed the beat and lowered myself to my knees, finding my reflection in a white glassy square. The floor was cooler than expected, the sensation welcoming. I pulled off my shoes and socks, acquainting my sweaty feet to the well-tended floor. I contemplated the black and white squares and thought of Etta Mae and the fun we could have there together. I set myself hopping across the floor in an elaborate array of hopscotch patterns, my feet slapping out a lively tempo. The sheer fun of it took hold, giggles spilling out and bouncing about the kitchen walls. Before I knew it, I ran out of floor, standing beneath the archway through which Mama had passed. I whispered out into the passage,
"Mama? Mercy?"
I pulled at the hem of my skirt and waited. Nothing. I lifted my right foot and poked my toes across the threshold, and then my left. Before I knew it, I was creeping through the place with my fast-growing legs. On the tips of my toes, I passed from one corridor to the next, driven by familiarity, a lightheadedness, a peculiar feeling Mama sometimes called déjà vu, a thing Miss Wessie called a remembrance. In the darkest passage I heard it, the piano, fast arpeggios, broken chords. Off the grand marble foyer it grew louder, sending red-hot quivers through my feet, pulling me into a mahogany-paneled room. Beneath a tumble of chandelier crystals, a woman, her back to the doorway, played a black baby grand piano. Dust motes waltzed in shafts of light falling across the piano, casting her in a spectral haze, her hands a beautiful chaos, her shoulders impossibly still. Barefoot, I crept across the wide planked floors, my fingers twitching and fidgeting at my sides, following and copying the notes. The weight of my body released the slightest creak. The woman's hands froze above the keys, the hysterical notes scattering the dust motes and tangling in the chandelier. Then the other feeling returned, that red-hot sensation making its way from my feet to my knees, burning all the way up my legs. Something was telling me I should run from the place. In a breath she stood, her movement so quick I questioned if she in fact had ever been sitting. Her face, it stupefied. The angles and curves and shadows, all of it assembled into a masterpiece. Her hair was blonde, a sort of color I never encountered before, a weaving of different shades, creating a rich depth of color tumbling in soft waves above her shoulders. From across the room she studied me, tilting her head from side to side. She moved across the floor, the movement so fluid and light her crocodile pumps hardly made a sound. She took hold, grabbing me by the shoulders. Her touch was hot, urging the burn I felt to move from my waist and spread across my chest. She leaned in, her stunning face so close I thought she might kiss me. When she set her breath against my face, she whispered a single melancholy word. "Patton." Not until then was I frightened. "Patton." I struggled, wriggling my shoulders. That is when she did it. I could smell the blow before it reached my cheek, perfume and setting lotion.
When her hand fell hard against my face, it was the softness of her skin I first noticed, then the sweet bracing sting. There was a shocking joy in her slap, a thrill of tingles, like riding in the back of a truck in a thunder.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?